Welcome to After the Buzzer. We're not in the man cave.
No.
We're in the luxurious penthouse above the man cave. Today, a little bit different feel, a little bit different vibe, it's still the same old delightful stuff.
It's a Cinco de Mayo version of
it. Yeah, who was the person? This is a trivia question. Who was the person who coined the Cinco de Mayo?
Oh.
It was about a game, right? What was the game and who was the person?
No idea.
All right, we'll ruminate on that a little bit. This is where I wish we could take some calls because somebody out there knows that.
Hello.
Anyway, I'm Mike Gross. He's Gordy Jones, and our guest today is former McCaskey basketball player, former Lancaster Catholic basketball player, current girls basketball coach at Lancaster Country Day, and also had an excellent run as a player, University of Delaware, and he's also a tweeting machine.
He is that.
On various topics, many of them hoop-related.
Indeed.
He is Devon Pinkard. Welcome to the big show, my man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
We have a little bit of a controversy, high school basketball-related right now, because the PIAA basketball committee has recommended to the board of directors, who will actually vote on this next week, that there not be a shot clock, which is something that a lot is being considered all over the country. So, Devon, let's go. What do you think about the shot clock? Would you want it or not?
I'm all for it. I think, yes.
Go ahead.
I think it's great for young players' development. I think people overlook that. I think, you know, I was talking with Jerry Johnson a little bit ago, and something he told me was when he was over in Europe and he had his son over there, son was 9, 10, 11 years old, whatever age he was, he said all of those kids are playing with a shot clock.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And we wonder why, you know, Luka Doncic comes over and we have, you know, guys like that, guys like Dirk Nowitzki that are skilled, and we wonder why those guys come over and are very successful, because of things like that. Your European game, man, is you know, they're sending some good stuff over there that I think that a lot of teams and stuff should adopt over here with us.
Now, an interesting, we should point out, just in the explaining this fully, that the PIAA did a survey where they asked the schools, and it was almost 50-50. It was very close to being, and they did a survey of referees, and they were in favor of it. It was pretty close, but, well, you know, over 50% were in favor of a shot clock, which you'd think would be making their job slightly more difficult. So that, I think that's noteworthy. And again, the actual vote about whether this is going to happen is up to the board of directors next week. So my question to you, Devon, is did you know about this? Were you surveyed? Did your AD ask you what you think about it?
Yeah, so Zach reached out to me a week or two ago, asked for my input. We briefly chatted. I just think that it's hard. I'm not even sure what he voted. You know what I mean? We didn't have a conversation afterwards, but I don't know what he voted. It was really his vote. And also, we have a boys coach, right? John, our boys coach at Country Day. He might not be in favor of it. So I'm not sure how our vote went, but yeah, I was asked by Zach. You know, heard from me, and again, I'm not sure what he voted or how, you know, Coach Schultz feels, but I talked, I guess, to Zach a little bit about it.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder, just as you laid out, I wonder who's actually doing the voting on that. Okay, now here's the other thing, which a lot of people have said. It's cost some money. The equipment costs some money. They have to hire an extra game staff person, which may not be as much of an issue at Lancaster Country Day as it is at a lot of other schools. And I wonder if that is the decisive thing for some people.
Yeah, listen, man, Country Day is penny pinching.
Oh, okay.
that'd probably be a problem for us too, man. So that's definitely a good argument. You know, I haven't thought much of that. I just think about, you know, like you mentioned, I play at Lancaster Catholic, and this might be a little bit of a stereotype, but I'm thinking about, you know, games are so long, right? Coming down, and, you know, passing and cutting, as you should. You're trying to look for the best shot, but, you know, teams hold the ball for 45, 50 seconds. It makes it hard. I think part of it for me is playing in college. I got to play with the shot clock, mm-hmm. right? Playing a season in Mexico, I got to play with the shot clock. And I am being biased because I know I can, you know, I'll three-quarter pressure a team. You know, maybe we don't get a 10-second call. That's fine. Maybe we take 9 seconds off the shot clock, and we're playing with 26 seconds on defense, yeah. and then mm-hmm. they take, 3 to 5 seconds to get into something. Then my girls are only playing defense for 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. So I like our chances of defending for 20 seconds and then having to corral a loose ball or box out and, you know, come up with a rebound rather than having my girls defend for 50 seconds to a minute.
Yeah.
That's something I thought about.
Yeah, that's true. And it seems to me, maybe I'm completely off base on this, but it seems to me that 20 years ago, that's how all the girls' basketball teams that won, that's what they did. That seems like that was, I mean, it's still pretty common, but it was much more common back in the day than it is now with what you just said. Let's speed the other team up and see what that gets us. That's interesting. Yeah.
So, Devon, I wonder what your takeaway was from your first year as a head coach. What was the big reveal for you as far as what you learned in your first year at Country Day?
You know, that's funny, man. Like, you know, you get into coaching because you want to teach,
right?
And you want to educate, you want to be a mentor. But I didn't realize how much I learned from these girls and from my staff throughout mm-hmm. the course of the year. You know, and I've always been somebody that, you know, I like to listen to my coaches and I soak all of that stuff in, right? And I remember being told, you know, as a young head coach, don't try to micromanage
right. And
do everything yourself and, you know, control everything. And I think I started to do that in the beginning of, you know, our summer workouts and even, you know, November, December when games started. And then I had to look over to, you know, my two assistants and, you know, we got our butts kicked. We were 8-0, 9-0. We got our butts kicked to Anvil Cleona.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to make some adjustments. And, you know, Shane Meadows was right there and said, "Coach, we got to change up how we run our offense." And I had to, you know, get over myself and my pride and be like, "Okay, I'm watching the film and we are not scoring the way we can." That's something I learned. Just using the people around me and trusting my staff, trusting my girls when they have something to say and they, you know, let their voice be heard. You know, you're seeing something out there. Mm-hmm. All right, let's run that then.
Because you had a lot of influences. I mean, obviously you played for Coach Powell at McCaskey. You played for Monte Ross at Delaware. Your dad's an AAU coach, and you worked.
Clazes.
Yeah, and you
Joe
worked.
Clazes.
You worked
yeah.
under Clazes, and you worked under Freddie Ramos too, right?
Yep.
So, what did you take from each of those?
Yeah, I played under Clazes first, man, and
oh, that's
you know, that was my first experience of high school basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was going to Reynolds Middle School my eighth grade year. Our team was undefeated. We were like 15-0. You know, I'm thinking I'm the man. Then I go to Catholic High, and like that's the first time I've actually worked. had to grind for a spot. And I'm thinking, you know, as a freshman, I'm gonna play varsity over here. Nope. I was playing JV, and I learned a lot from that staff in general, not just Coach Clazes. Like, the staff over there is amazing. Coach Heisey, you know, and Coach Fern, especially Coach Heisey, he was somebody that really pushed me to be a better player. And I think just their passion for coaching and really their school. Like, everybody on that coaching staff was a graduate of Catholic High.
Yeah.
And they came back and, you know, they had pride in and winning games and making sure that we're successful
mm-hmm.
adults, man. So going there, learning that stuff, and then playing under Coach Powell and his staff, and it took me, you know, my junior year, I had to adjust. And you know, it took me some time to really get comfortable, but when I did, you know, we had a lot of fun, and we made a nice little run, you know, especially my senior year. But, yeah, I've definitely had some great people in my life that have shaped – you know, the way I coach, Even like, you know, with Coach Ross, man, like in college,
mm-hmm.
he was about relationships, and he was about, you know, like togetherness and family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, you know, if you can get your team to buy into playing together and for one another,
mm-hmm.
You'll be very successful, man. So I definitely took, you know, something away from all of my coaches. And obviously, you know, my dad's the one that put the ball in my hand, you know, once I came out of my mom, pretty much, man. So like, my dad is, we still talk. He'll watch game film, you know, of the girls, and he'll tell me some things that he sees, and, you know, come to practice even from time to time and just check us out. And yeah, you know, so I've definitely been blessed with some great mentors.
That's neat.
I was, I remember some years ago when Lebanon Catholic was such a power in Class A girls basketball, and Country Day got to the district final for the first time, and they really got hammered by Lebanon Catholic. But anyway, I remember writing a column about how at Country Day, like, practices were sort of optional, and it was really pretty casual. I'm sure that that's changed, but is there any sort of residue of that where sports are used to be sort of a casual thing at that school?
Don't get me started, man.
Okay.
Oh my goodness.
I got you started.
Yeah.
I heard your little chuckle there in the mid question. Yeah.
and credit to the girls, because, and I mean no disrespect when I say this, this might have been the first year, and this is just, you know, off of my feedback from the girls, you know, when we have our postseason meetings and things like that, but this was probably the first year that, like, it wasn't an option. It was the first year, for sure, that we had tryouts. You know, I knew everybody was going to make the team. They didn't necessarily know that. I kind of scared them a little bit and told them, you know, it's tryouts, you got to be here.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that level of commitment definitely wasn't a thing before this season, man. Mm. And, you know, they have never done summer, I'm talking just for the girls' basketball team at least, but like summer workouts and open gyms and summer league and fall league, those things were non-existent. So coming in and trying to, you know, build that culture of, you know, like, and I want them to play other sports. We're at a small school, they're going to play multiple sports.
Sure.
I'm encouraging that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But when you're not on vacation this summer, I expect an open gym or summer league or, you know, team camp.
Yeah.
And I think last year it was kind of hard because I got hired late, you know, in July, and we, you know, we did fall league and we didn't get complete buy-in. But once we started winning games this year, man, you know, everybody was like, I remember after the season, I had a mom come up to me. She's like, Coach Pink, could I get it now? I get why you have fall league and you're doing all these things. Like, it's hard to win basketball games. It's not easy. You know, you want to be competitive. And we're not just trying to win basketball games, but, you know, just teaching the level of commitment that you're going to have throughout life.
Mm-hmm.
And credit to the girls and their families, because they bought in, you know, and we're gonna be in the gym here soon, you know, with summer league next month and open gyms and all those things and, you know, weight room. And they bought in.
It's a funny thing about sports, you know, it's easy, especially at the high school level, you want to say winning isn't everything, but you're not getting what you want to get out of the sport if you're not trying to win, right? There's no way around that. Yeah. You have a great player, an all-state player on your team. Tell us a little bit about Genesis Meadows and what it's like coaching her, and what kind of a kid, what kind of a player.
She's an amazing student athlete. You know, you talk about classroom, she excels. You know, I think she has like a 3.8 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Tremendous student. I mean, you guys see her on the court, she's phenomenal. You talk about such a skilled player, pound for pound, you know. And like you guys said, I coached at Catholic with David Kamwanga. He's played Division I basketball, yep. Elijah Terry, Division II. She's the most skilled player I've ever coached. And I've only been coaching for a few years, I get that. But she is amazing. Like, and this year she stepped up as a leader for us, which was fun to watch, you know, her maturation of like, just like, being able to speak up and command the huddle and to encourage your teammates. You know, we try to stay positive with everybody, and to watch her, like, put her teammates in positions to score. And not, obviously, she's a tremendous 55 three-pointers this year. The last 2 years, mm-hmm. the most three-pointers in the league. You know, she can shoot the basketball. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now her being able to drive to the paint, find teammates, dump it off, you know, she's phenomenal. And what's cool is, you know, and I, you know, like I've said, I'm just so grateful because things have always worked out for me. I met her dad 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago now, actually. I was a substitute teacher in Swinishka Lancaster. Her dad has been teaching for almost like 30 years or whatever at a local middle school. And I met him, and, you know, him and his buddy Ty Berry is a teacher there as well. We hit it off, and they have like this nonprofit called Advance Lancaster, where they invited me to work there in the summers. This summer, you know, I'll be working with them again, and that's how I met them. And, you know, the job opened up, so obviously, you know, Mr. Meadows and I are talking, and he's like, "Listen, man, you know, Coach left, and this is open. Maybe check it out." And I wasn't interested. I wasn't interested at first because I said, you know, what's the team look like? And I was a little nervous. I was skeptical. But, you know, when you have Genesis on your roster, man, you can make things happen. It's up to you after that as a coach to put people in the right position and try to win some games when you have, like you said, two-time All-State player on your team who's primed for a big senior year. And you can't turn down that opportunity.
What more do you expect from her as a senior, you know, given what she's already accomplished?
That's tough. I think something we always say is we say 1%, mm-hmm. meaning just get 1% better each day. Hmm. That's all she can do. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Her stats may not be better next season. I have no idea. But as long as she just continues to get better, as she continues to, because we're losing two seniors mm-hmm. who were, you know, one was a great leader for us, very vocal. The other led by example and just was, you know, a hard worker. And the other two seniors, they didn't play very much, but they were tremendous. They both brought things that really helped us. So we're losing some veteran, you know, a veteran presence, and we need her to step up. And she's got to shoulder that load mm-hmm. In terms of being able to lead by example, but also be the vocal leader and, you know, do some other things that she probably didn't do this season that doesn't, you know, you don't see on the stat sheet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's capable of it. Mm-hmm. She's capable. She can do it.
How different is it coaching boys as opposed to girls?
It's not much different. I'll tell you, I think boys can be hard-headed. Mm-hmm. I think boys can be, if you can, it's, you know, this is where it's the same. Mm-hmm. It's relationships.
Yeah.
It's, you know, how can you relate to them? And, you know, sometimes you can't talk about basketball. You have to talk about, hey, man, like, you know, how's school going?
Right.
You know, how's life? Like, you know, you just got to get to know them. And I think that's the same with both. And more so with boys, you have to really do that or they will not listen to you. They won't buy into what you're teaching. Yeah, boys, you know, that's funny. You know, I truly, people ask me this all the time. Do you prefer to coach boys or girls? Right, I prefer to coach girls. Like, and maybe I'm just at a great school and, you know, have some great girls, but coaching these girls has been amazing. You know, they've, like I said, they've bought in from the beginning, and I thought that would be a challenge because, you know, I've never coached girls. I was, you know, I've never necessarily been like a mentor for any girls or anything like that. So I was nervous taking the job. I didn't know, you know, how they would react to me as a coach, but it's been a positive experience. I have truly enjoyed it, and you know, I don't think it's much different. I really do think it's like just relationships and trying to gain that trust. And as long as they believe in you and what you're saying, mm-hmm. you know what I mean. I could be a terrible coach, but if they believe in whatever I'm telling them, you know, it might just work.
It's funny. I've asked dozens of men coaches who have coached boys and girls that same question, and I think every single one of them has said some version of, boys can be hard-headed. But you just, I think that's a very, there is a difference, and I think that's a really succinct maybe way of saying what the difference is, yeah. Hmm.
So what about your tweeting here, Devon? You are an active social media person, and you are not averse to sharing your opinions. I wonder, I mean, as much as anybody could have a philosophy about social media, what is your approach to this whole avenue?
Yeah, I love Twitter. Mm-hmm. I think you know that, but I grew up on Twitter. Like, I remember being in high school, right. And not many people were on Twitter at that point.
Right.
But like, my entire high school basketball team was. All of our friends were at McCaskey, so we were all tweeting each other, and we would subtweet. Like, so that's kind of been what I grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
I took some time off of it when I went to college, just because I would get so many tweets from like people that gambled on games or like just random fans, and they, you know, they say some rude stuff to you, man. But I got back on it recently, and you know, like you said, I think, you know, social media can be good, it can be bad, as with anything. There are times though where, you know, I kind of have to like tone it down. Just like, I don't say anything crazy.
No, you don't. I don't think so.
I do say a lot. I do let my, you know, opinion be known sometimes. And you know, it's funny. You know, that you have seen that stuff. Sometimes I'm not sure if my tweets are even seen, just because no one reacts to it. I'm not saying that you had to, but sometimes I'm just like talking to myself on there. But
I know it does feel like that sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. That is true.
But yeah, man. Like I definitely like talking hoops on there. I love when people respond, and like I put up a some random person tweeted like, you know, name the five best basketball players to come out of your high school.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
I did see your list.
That
yeah.
That was a cool conversation. You know,
yeah, that was.
People tweet back and say like, you know, oh, that's cool. Like, did you think about this person? I was like, oh, actually I did. And like, they were tremendous. Like,
yeah.
So, and I want to clear this up though. I was taking it as like career in like not just high school, but a college career, professional career.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you're talking about just like the best five players, McCaskey, like just McCaskey career, that's a tough.
That's a hard list. That's a hard list to break down.
Sure if you can, I'm not sure if you can pick just five. Like that's tough. But yeah, man, I love Twitter. I think it's great.
Yeah, so I'll give an example to our listening audience. To earlier today, the announcement came about Draymond Green being fined $25,000 for flipping the double bird after he was injured against the Grizzlies the other night, and your comment was worth every penny.
I've never done anything like that. I wish I had the balls to do that, but I thought what he did was hilarious. His comment after the game, he said, you know, I make $25 million a year, I think I'll be just fine. So he thinks the same thing, I guess.
Yeah. The thing that's cool with Twitter is when something happens in sports and everybody's commenting on it.
Yeah, real time.
Like, like say an NFL playoff game and there's some terrible call by the officials and people are jumping. I mean, that's, I think Twitter is good for sports.
I do like that. Like when the Sixers are on, I'm always on there and, you know, throwing stuff out. I got into this long, pointless argument the other week because I said that Maxey was probably as fast as anybody in Sixers history, save Iverson. I didn't think that was that controversial. So somebody decided that, what are you talking about? You can't compare him to Iverson, and on and on and on it went.
Well, yeah. Another thing is, sometimes I'm surprised at the things that get mega retweets, and as we said a minute ago, the things that get ignored. I'm really surprised at that sometimes. Some of the most benign stuff.
Yeah, like that. Like what I said.
Yeah, I don't know. But it is. It can be fun in sports. Other areas,
I enjoy, you know, the Doc Rivers hate, man, on Twitter. I see you guys talking about rotations and all these things. I don't watch the Sixers enough to know. But it's just funny because I have, obviously, you know, live in Lancaster. I have friends that are Sixers fans.
Yeah.
And just flat out hating Doc right now, man. It's funny to watch. Cause I'm not a Sixer fan, but I enjoy watching Philly sports lose games.
Well, that is usually more entertaining, actually, right. because of the reaction.
God. Yeah, then it gets insane. Yeah.
Because before Doc, Brett Brown was the one always getting trashed. So.
Yeah, that's right. Two coaches in a row. Yeah. So Devon, what do you want to? You want to coach for the long haul? You want to coach in college, or what? I realize it's hard to know what journey you're gonna, you know, what twists and turns it'll take. But are you thinking about a coaching career?
Yeah, I am. You know, and it's funny because when I first was like when I was volunteering with Catholic High and Coach Clay's brought me on, I didn't take it very serious. And I was afraid of the responsibility of, you know, at the time coaching young men. And, you know, I always knew, just like with my dad, that I wanted to coach, but I think I was a little scared of, you know, going all in and failing at it and not being good at it.
Yeah.
But I think throughout the course of my first year coaching at Catholic, I realized, you know, I love being around kids. I love talking the game, and just, you know, they made me feel young. They made me feel, you know, I enjoyed, you know, the conversations and the laughs we had.
Mm-hmm.
But I also enjoyed when it came down to it, you know, practice planning and really grinding out a hard practice and being there to encourage people and say, hey, let's go, we can do this.
Hmm.
Things like that really made me realize, okay, you know, this is something I want to do. And that's part of the reason why I went to McCaskey afterwards to coach, because I knew I'd have an opportunity to, you know, Mike, after my conversation with, you know, Coach Freddie, I knew I'd have an opportunity to really let my voice be heard and really develop as a coach. Not that Coach Clay just wasn't doing that, but there's so many coaches over there, and, you know, me being in my first year there, it took me time to really get into it. But then, you know, once I did, I knew, okay, McCaskey's where I need to be. I'm going to have an opportunity to really grow and develop as a young coach. And my 2 years there were phenomenal. I really did get to grow and to see what worked and what didn't work, especially being the JV coach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to experiment a little bit. Nobody cares if you win or lose games at JV. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So we're trying to develop kids, and I got to also develop a little bit, you know, under the staff there and under, you know, playing or coaching, you know, those boys over there. So I do see myself coaching in the long run. I'd like to have a successful high school career as a coach before I go into college. I love to win a district title, you know, a league title, and then, you know, hopefully a state title at some point. But I also don't want to be in high school basketball for, you know, for 10 years, unless it's the right fit. And, you know, I'm not like, you know, IMG or something, get paid like six figures, but I'd love to, you know, have a solid four years at Country Day, five years, and move on and become a head coach out of college. And something, you know, growing up and living, you know, I lived on Pine Street, which is, you know, the west end of town, and I went to Reynolds. And growing up, my dad took my brother and I to a lot of FNN games.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I saw you guys at Glenn Robinson on your podcast, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you know,
we
I grew up going to FNN games, and I remember thinking as a kid, I'm going to go to school here and play basketball.
Mm.
Obviously, as I got older, I realized, you know, I want to go to school for free and I can go to these other places. But
yeah.
I love to coach at Division III school, be a head coach, and, you know, say it is a local school and I get to recruit local talent to come play for me, that would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be fun.
So that's something I've thought about. So, you know, we'll see where this takes me. Like I said, I think things have always fallen into place for me. And as long as I continue to work and do the right things,
mm-hmm.
they will continue to do so.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you that this goes back several months, but I speaking of Twitter, this is something you commented on. It was obviously a very sensitive situation. The Cedar Crest McCaskey game, where it first sounded like somebody uttered a racial slur, and it turned out that he was saying Thon Maker and not that. And Freddie Ramos's comment was, well, this is not an isolated thing. This is something that we hear a lot of places. And you commented on that on Twitter. That's true. So I wonder, how hard is that to play, those being the circumstances? And is it worse in high school? Is it worse in college? Or is this sort of just a universal kind of thing that you just have to deal with the day-to-day and game-to-game?
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate. I think a lot of young, you know, boys and girls are faced with that, mm-hmm. especially, you know, in Lancaster County. Mm-hmm. Look, if I'm being completely honest, mm-hmm. being in Lancaster County, Lebanon County, being in the LLE, you're gonna, you know, and it's unfortunate. Like, you know, you're going, even if you go to, like, I remember playing at McCaskey, mm-hmm. right? And we're playing, it could be Penn Manor, it could be Town, it could be whoever it is in Section 1.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear certain things, and you know, like, I want to remind people, like, and I'm, like, I won't get too deep into it, but we would hear things about, like, SAT scores and all these things.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had 3 Division I players on our team that were, you know, IB and honors kids with me, Deontay, and Aaron. Like,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? We all Aaron really went good to students, Living Mary. Sure. Yeah. Deontay and I went to Delaware. You know what I mean? Like, we went to quality colleges,
mm-hmm.
earned degrees, or, you know, we have good lives, right? You know, so it's unfortunate that, you know, we are faced with those stereotypes and things like that. I will say this too with the Thon Maker thing. Say that person did say Thon Maker. That mm-hmm. doesn't make it okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because what, Thon Maker is black, he's African, right? He's dark skinned. And so was, I believe it was Hostin that was on the floor,
mm-hmm.
that was directed to. Or maybe it was Jared, yeah. because Jared's African. It was one of those two. But what are you trying to say? Because he looks like Thon Maker because he's black?
Mm-hmm.
Or because maybe they're African? They don't look anything alike.
Yeah.
You know, so what are you trying to say? That's still inappropriate.
Yeah, that's what I thought about the Thon Maker thing. That makes it weirder, but it doesn't really make it better. It just makes it weirder. Thon Maker, what the hell? I was a little piece of me was kind of impressed that they knew who Thon Maker is. I mean, what a relatively obscure basketball player. Jeez. Thon Maker. Wow.
But what do you do in those situations, Devon? Do you just not hear it? Do you just tone it out? Or how do you deal with that night in, night out?
I don't know. And you see it all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Not just our country, but you see it all around the world where, you know, people of color have to find a way to cope with it, to put up with it, you know? And you, I don't say that meaning you just, you know, you take the disrespect or anything like that, but like you have to find a way to, I don't know.
You can't go up in the stands and fight every time. Yes, yeah.
Right. You're not gonna, you know, and then you look even worse because, oh, look at this, you know,
right, right.
Person of color going in the stands starting to fight. You know?
Right.
We're in a tough position, you know, and that's why I do applaud the McCaskey boys, you know, for that incident and, you know, you want to say, you know, let's educate people, but at the same time, they are adults, some of those people, unless you're in high school or whatever, but a lot of people that I have heard things from are adults.
Yeah.
Right.
You're an adult, and you're, you know, not educated on certain things, and you're saying inappropriate stuff to kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not on the kids to, you know what I mean? That's a white person's problem. That's on them to figure out, you know, how to handle things, not us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's well said.
And yet it was so impressive the way the McCaskey kids and Freddie did handle that. And it seems to have passed. The real controversy has passed. It'll be interesting to see what happens next year when McCaskey goes into Cedar Crest Gym or whatever. But that's crazy.
I mean, I don't remember even how Cedar Crest handled it. But it's also on them then, like I said, when it's kind of their problem to fix, it's on them, you know, the administration in the, you know, in the school district, at the school, the athletic director, whoever, to step in and okay, this person can't come back to, you know, another game or whatever it is. Like, there has to be some sort of repercussion for, you know, what they're saying to student athletes.
No question.
No question.
All right. Well, Devon, you wondered if you could hang. If it's not a problem, you could hang. Thanks for doing it, man. We appreciate you.
We appreciate the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Keep tweeting, buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
All right, be well. Right. Take care.
Thanks, Devon.
Anyway, I thought his comments, Devon Pinkard's comments about just that whole obviously terribly sensitive situation were well considered, and I don't know if there is a good answer for something like that.
No, there isn't, and I'm really interested in seeing what, if anything, happens next year. It's sort of one of those things, like in all areas of our culture, where there's a flap and then everybody kind of forgets about it for a while, and then they go to the next controversy. And we'll see.
I don't know if this is still the case, because I haven't covered a high school game in forever, but do they still read the code of conduct before the game?
Oh, yeah.
That never seems to make an impact.
No, which, that's correct.
Sadly.
That's correct, yeah. The code of conduct is tuned out. I kind of tune it out, to be honest, because I've heard it 100,000 times.
I hear you. But you wish somebody would, just... consider what's going on here. Consider the dynamic in place. Consider
That's right.
It's like, it's one thing to be enthusiastic. It's another thing to go there, And, the things that he said, it's like, what are you talking about? SAT scores. I mean, that's like the worst stereotype you could ever throw out there.
I know. So I didn't think about that. What great students those kids were. I mean, those kids were really good students and ended up going to...
And then Devon has a master's degree now.
He's done okay.
So we move on to other topics, and one of those is something you wrote about on Sunday, which is about Penn State having a new athletic director, Patrick Kraft, late of Boston College, former Indiana walk-on, and your impressions are what?
This is very, very, very much a football hire. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much James Franklin, how much input he had into it, but I thought it was very interesting that in Kraft's introductory press conference, he touched on some things that were specific things that Franklin has said we have to work on.
Mm-hmm.
The big theme with him last year, Franklin, was we have to make sure everybody's on the same page as far as trying in every area to be as good as we can be in football. That's what it takes. We're in an arms race for facilities, for staff, for advisors and such. They did increase their number of advisors a little bit, their number of the recruiting staff a little bit. But Kraft played in the Big Ten. He was a walk-on in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very much a football guy. He's also seen as very much a fundraising guy.
Oh,
and that
big.
Was perceived to be the weakness of Sandy Barber, the previous AD. Here's another thing. I almost hesitate to bring this up, but there are some people in the Penn State community for whom it's significant that this is a white man. Given what we were just talking about, I know it. I've gotten emails from readers where that's been very out front, and then I've gotten some where I think people have let the cat out of the bag about what part of their thinking is without meaning to.
It's so disappointing.
It's so disheartening.
In 2022, people are still.
I think there are some people who think that to an extent even Franklin, but certainly Barber, were diversity hires. So now we're getting back to, let's really try. You know what I mean? I'm hesitant. Maybe I shouldn't have brought that up. But I think that's a small piece of this. Ultimately he'll be judged by, I think, fundraising and by how they win on the field.
It is such a gargantuan job, because what is it, 32 sports
30,
now?
31 intercollegiate
that's,
teams.
That is pretty, maybe not unwieldy, but certainly an over overwhelming task, I would think, on a lot of levels.
And it is. You're right. And here's what a lot of people don't realize about college sports. Clemson has like 16 intercollegiate teams. I mean, in Alabama, most of these schools that are in the Sun Belt that are football, monster football, that Penn State is recruiting against and trying to compete with, don't have a fencing team, don't have a field hockey team, don't have anything like the scope of this, and the fundraising situation is, at least structurally on the record, a little bit more loose, and Penn State always says, our athletic department funds itself. They always say that, and on the they give you the paperwork to indicate that they do, and funds itself means football, the football program making a lot of money, really, because nothing else really makes a lot of money. Basketball, interestingly, the sports that don't lose money at Penn State are football, of course, which makes $50 million a year about, men's and women's basketball, and that's almost entirely because of the TV deal, the NCAA tournament TV deal. And the coming much bigger deal that the women are about to get.
Okay.
And the other one is ice hockey, which, you know, they happen to have a billionaire who built them an arena for ice hockey, who is an alumnus. So, you know, like wrestling doesn't make money. It's the best wrestling program in the country, without question. Yeah. And they play before some big crowds at times, but they don't make money. You know, any of the other ones. They lose money.
I'm reminded of what Joe told us for years. Hey, we got 29 other sports to support.
And I'm also reminded of the old line about football in the South, how there are two seasons, football and spring football. Yeah, not too much of an exaggeration.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I rolled my eyes a little bit at Joe saying that, because that was his rationalization for some things that I didn't completely buy, you know, some specific things like we can't play, we can't give Pitt a home and home. You know, that was part of that. You know,
I was reminded of that when Syracuse came on the schedule this week for 27 and 28,
I think.
Yeah, because that was this thing about them all the time. Hey, they wouldn't give us an extra home game. Joe, come on.
Come on. I think during that stretch of 27, 28, they're going to be playing Temple, Delaware, Syracuse? It's kind of like the old Eastern Independence.
There we go. We're back to that.
Yeah, back to the future.
So anyway, but it'll be interesting to see how things unfold for Patrick, given what we just said. It is a big, big job.
Yeah.
And I would say bigger than most, correct?
Yeah, bigger than most. Absolutely. There aren't many schools that have that many sports, and most of the ones who do have gargantuan private endowments. Stanford, you know, Princeton, those schools have huge sports programs, but obviously not the scope of football, where they're putting 107,000 people in New Haven, Connecticut, or Princeton, New Jersey, and, you know.
So is Patrick going to fix the press box ever?
Don't hold your breath, big guy. Don't hold your breath. It's fun. This is something that I actually do not quite understand. Not just the press box, but they came up with this strategic plan, facilities plan, and this big vision for the future, public meeting. And, like, the beef is at the end of it.
I know.
Not the beginning,
end. I remember that. Because, you know, when they did the mock-up of what the stadium looks like, to me, the stadium always looks incomplete. Like, it needs to have a facade.
Yeah.
And that's what it would have under this, you know, like a nice stone facade, which I think would be beautiful. Because right now, all you see are girders.
Yeah.
I hate it.
The bigger Rector set.
Yeah, it is.
And it does look unfinished. Yeah. Right. And partly that's because whenever they increased the size of the place, which they've more than doubled the size of the place over its history, I think.
Yeah.
They just, like, slapped another tier on it, you know.
Well, the first thing they didn't they like way back when they moved the stadium across campus.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When it was real small.
Yeah.
And then to where its present site, and then as you say, it's like we'll just build up, but like it needs a facade if you're looking at, you know, just sheer aesthetics. That's what it needs.
And a lot of stadiums, like for example, the big house at Michigan.
Yeah.
That when I first started covering Penn State, that was a pretty. It wasn't the Rector said thing like Penn State, but it was a very bland, just sort of gargantuan space, and they've put a sort of nice facade on that and made it look like an impressive facility.
I've only been there, I think, once, and what I remember is how much of it's below street level.
Yes.
Too. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, and I like that setup, though.
Yeah,
I like
too.
The setup at Ann Arbor. I like that pre-game sort of environment there. You know, most of the changes they've made have been mostly cosmetic. Of course, they added luxury boxes because,
of course,
that's a big money.
Speaking of dollars.
Yeah, you got to entertain these... You got to entertain the head of the State Senate Appropriations Committee, of course.
So we wanted to talk about the Sixers as well. They're down 0-2, and we just got word today that Joel Embiid will not play Game 3, which I think is pretty much the death knell for their season. So if you're king of the Sixers for a day, what do you do to fix them this offseason?
It's a really tough call because they have this situation with Harden, where they have to figure out whether to pay him an awful lot of money, and it's so interesting to watch him play now because it's a couple of things. There's a couple of things that are going on. I think one of them is that the way they the way the game's officiated has changed a little bit and not in his favor.
No, I
think 3-4 years ago he was able to take advantage of the officials as much as any NBA player I've ever seen, and that's kind of gone.
Yeah.
I think teams are just defending that sort of spread offense thing. I think they're defending that better now.
Yeah.
If you look at the and teams that ISO, I think teams have kind of figured out this perimeter-oriented spread offense, for lack of a better term. I think they've started to figure that out. I mean, you look at what the Celtics are doing.
Oh, my gosh. That's impressive.
Yeah, that's the best example of it. But and then the other thing is, he can't blow around people the way he wants to.
That's what I was going to mention.
Yeah, that's kind of the bottom line, I think.
If you can't win that one-on-one matchup, then that offense is, you know, it's kaput.
I was always amazed at how he could get to the rim because he never looked super quick to me, but now he can't. So I guess he's, you know.
So, I mean, I guess they're almost compelled to re-sign him just because of what they gave up to get him. But, I mean, that's a big chunk of money. I mean, I think it's $223 million over 4 years or something like that.
And
that's a lot of money for a guy who looks like he's shot now, much less 4 years from now.
That's right. I would not say, well, we're compelled to sign him because of what we gave up. I would not think that way. It's just the old economic idea of some cost. You got to figure out what's right now, and that would be my thinking. But then what?
Yeah, then what is right?
Because you really have to use whatever resources you were using gonna sign him to get foundational pieces, right?
I mean,
you have to think about these next 2 or 3 years as our window with Embiid at his peak.
Yep. It's a really tricky equation because, you know, as we all recall, they gave up not only Ben Simmons, but also Seth Curry and Andre Drummond. And what do they need now? Seth Curry and Andre Drummond. You know, basically they don't have a backup center. DeAndre Jordan's shot. Seth Curry would be a really valuable guy in this race. And
I've thought about that a lot since he hasn't been there, how much they miss him, how nice he would look in so many spots.
And this is one of those 2020 hindsight questions, but it really leads me to wonder if they would have been better off trading Simmons for C.J. McCollum or Tyrese Halliburton or fill in the blank, because there were all those trade rumors out there for months. You know, and admittedly, that's a 2020 hindsight question, because at the time, you didn't think James Harden would be this.
Yeah, that's right. But on the other hand, I remember you being pretty high on C.J. McCollum, and I think higher than I was. But watching him play in the playoffs, I think you were right.
He was really good. Yeah,
and then you kind of start Maxi on the project of becoming a point guard.
And he seems like he's a pretty quick study in addition to just being quick. Period. So I think it might have worked out.
Yeah.
You know, think about that. If you didn't have to give up as much for him, let's say, you know, if you could have kept Seth Curry. So then you have Curry and McCollum and Maxi. That's a pretty good combination.
Yeah.
In my humblest. And to me, that's the really telling thing about the Sixers. They just don't have enough guys. Even with Embiid, they just don't have enough guys
they can really trust. They really look shallow. In these two games of Miami, it's really looked really look like they just don't have enough basketball players. And that's true. They that's what the deal is. It looks that way because that's the reality of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I think they look a little beat to me. I mean, Danny Green, for example, I mean, he's a pro, but I've seen him make some really lazy plays mm-hmm. in these two games where you just kind of...
Yeah, you wonder if he's shot.
Ambling around. Yeah. Maybe he's shot, yeah.
And then it's like, coupled with that is like the player development aspect. Matisse Thybulle hasn't developed his offensive game. Furkan Korkmaz has taken a huge step backwards this year. I mean, before we started tonight, we looked and he shot less than 30% from three this year, which is what he does.
Yeah.
So he was like out of the rotation. So then you have that piece of it. And then, you know, DeAndre Jordan, which this kind of leads into the Doc Rivers point. DeAndre Jordan, they got him. He's obviously done. And then you have Doc Rivers like being defiant about it. We're going to play him no matter what you think. Well, what is that?
He's been a little more belligerent lately.
Yes, I think so too.
The thing where he was defending his record.
Yeah. And three to one leads. He's blown 3-3-1 leads.
Yeah. I mean that's a little. I think that's a little unfair to him. I mean I think some of what he said in his defense was pretty on the
money. At the same time, you kind of.
But yeah. I don't want to hear him. I don't really hear that.
No.
You know, that's not really.
No, and it leads me to wonder if he's out the door. That's what it leads me to wonder.
Well, it's certainly possible. I think that's a strong possibility. In mm-hmm. fact, I've talked to some people who think Jay Wright is sitting out there.
Jay Wright says he's not coming back.
I don't think so either. I don't think it's happening.
I mean, Silski has him on the record saying that. He's tweeted it a bunch of times. Like every time a rumor comes up, like since Jay stepped down, and Jay said, no, let me be clear about this. I'm not coaching again.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
I don't think that's going to happen, but...
I don't think it's the right spot for him, even if he were. He's a college guy. I think that's where he is.
Yeah. And the other thing, this is another thing that people are going to point to, the thing where they're up 30 and Embiid's still on the floor with 3 minutes left, that's sort of coaches. That's how coaches are.
I never understand it.
I was talking about this with somebody the other day, too. It's beyond my comprehension. How about this? This is something you see in high school. The coach who's up 30, he's not going to clear his guys till the other coach.
I know.
Yeah. It's like this ceremonial thing where, okay, now.
Yeah, you have to concede. It's like, you know. Like,
and I know, you know, up 30 with 4 minutes in an NBA game. No, just take him the hell out.
Yeah.
You know, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of 2012 where the Sixers were playing the Bulls game one. And Tom Thibodeau, who's notorious for overusing his guys anyway, had Derrick Rose out there with X number of minutes left. They're up 20. He hurts his knee. They lose the series because of that. It's sort of this. But I've never understood that mindset. Why are guys still out there up 20 with like literally a minute left? That's when they'll finally do it.
It's utterly typical of coaches at all levels and in football and basketball for sure.
Yeah.
I've never understood it. It's exhibit number a zillion that I don't think like a football or basketball coach. I've never understood it. And Doc, when they asked Doc about this, he even said, well, Toronto still had their starters out there. He even said that.
Almost like a macho thing. Like, I want him to concede. Yeah, I want him to bend to my will.
That's kind of what it is, I think. That is absurd.
It is. Because
think about what you're risking.
And look how it's bitten him
and
now.
Look how it played out. Injuries are the ultimate... constant X factor in all sports, all the time.
Yes.
If you can mitigate that to any small extent and you're not hurting, what are you hurting? Mm-hmm. You got the game won.
Yeah.
Why would you not do it?
I don't get it at all. And especially given their circumstances where they're a couple guys short to begin with.
Yeah.
And especially given Embiid's value.
Yeah, you know, which is considerable.
It outweighs pretty much everything else about their team. And if they don't have him, they're just not a competitive playoff team.
Now, is he not available for Game 3 because he has not completed the concussion protocol?
I'm not positive about that.
Because I'm not even sure what is the concussion protocol in the NBA.
That's the question.
Yeah, I mean, you kept hearing him say that, and you didn't hear any explanation of like. How long is it?
Yeah.
Which we used to hear back in the day, we would hear that all the time. And
Anyway, but yeah, so that's, I think we can pretty much put a bow around the Sixers season. And,
yeah.
And once again, another angst-ridden season is coming quickly to a close.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, does this Embiid injury, does it maybe save Doc's job a little bit? Because, you know, you can't really put it on him.
I mean, it's like, does he want to be somewhere else?
maybe
he's already got the shits of coaching in Philly.
Yeah, I don't get the sense that he is having a lot of fun.
No, it certainly does not seem that way.
The other thing is that he seems to be unduly respectful of his veteran players, which we're seeing with the... What's his name? The center.
DeAndre Jordan.
Yeah.
They have a long-standing relationship, so I guess that's what goes into that. But anyway, the last thing we wanted to talk about was just how the Eagles kind of won draft day. They traded for A.J. Brown, a great wide receiver, and they drafted two Georgia defensive guys, which is never a bad way to go. Jordan Crazy. Davis, the big defensive tackle, and excuse me if I'm not pronouncing this correctly, but N'Kobe Dean?
No, it's N'Kobe. N'Kobe Dean. Dean he dropped... I think it was surprising how far he dropped. I think the Eagles were genuine. They always say that. Well, I can't believe we got him in the fourth. They always say that. But in this case, I think it's true. They were talking about this on the coverage of draft night. He's an undersized linebacker, and he's not crazy athletic, but he's really good. His football instincts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that Georgia defense may have been one of the greatest and certainly one of the most athletic.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the big guy they got in the first round.
Jordan Davis.
He's 340 pounds, and he runs a 4.7-something 40. I don't...
Can you even imagine that?
Yeah.
It would be like a refrigerator chasing you.
Yeah.
I mean, literally.
Yeah. His highlights. YouTube that dude. Watching him run around. It's funny. I mean, he's a... And the other thing, interesting thing about this is he's from... I think he's from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
He was... First of all, he was not a high-level recruit at all.
Isn't that
for
weird?
Some reason.
Isn't that weird?
Supposedly, Georgia is like on the cutting edge of having this gargantuan staff of recruiting advisors. And supposedly, we don't care what anybody else says. We know, go get this dude.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Good for them.
They have a little bit of an edge there, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. Georgia had more players drafted than anybody else. Notre Dame was second. Who was third and fourth?
No idea.
Fourth was Penn State.
Whoa. Who knew?
Three was Cincinnati.
What?
How about that? A non-Power Five. Isn't that interesting?
That's right.
More than Alabama. More than Ohio State. More than LSU. Penn State had eight players drafted.
I did not know that.
Including the punter in the fourth round to the Ravens.
Yes. Well, my team, the Packers, took Rasheed Walker in the seventh round.
Yes.
As a developmental guy. And speaking of Georgia, they also drafted two Georgia defensive guys. They took Quay Walker, who was a linebacker, at 22. And that was sort of... For the reasons you just mentioned, that why did they not take Dean? So I guess they saw something on tape that they
maybe more upside. I think Dean is seen as maybe a little bit limited. I mean, I guess his testing numbers weren't
which
off
you
the
know
charts.
That's always one of those either or propositions.
Yeah, I know.
It's like if a guy's productive. You know, if he can play, he can play.
Yeah.
You know, and especially at that level.
And that's what I think that's what makes the draft interesting.
Yes,
because there's
I agree.
So many. A very interesting, and our buddy Dave wrote about this the other day. A very interesting Penn State test of this is Brandon Smith.
Yeah.
Because he went in the fourth round to the Panthers,
mm-hmm.
who have they have a really good linebackers coach. Matt Rhule is mm-hmm. the head
sure.
coach there. He is a really athletic guy who's big and athletic,
mm-hmm.
and but he was not a very good college football player.
Isn't that weird?
And you could I wonder if it wasn't partly that you could because he plays more in space, you could see his shortcomings a little more.
Mm-hmm.
He's a guy who you can imagine matching up with all of these great tight ends. You know what I mean? He could be a cover guy for Rob Gronkowski and Jason Kelsey because of his size and athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a long way to go, but Dave is high on him. Dave, and I kind of think In the fourth round, that was a pretty good pick.
Yeah, fourth round picks tend to pan out a lot more often than you realize, I think.
That's kind of in the middle, but it's not like a guy that everybody wants, and it's not, maybe this guy can play in the league. It's kind of in between.
Yeah, a lot of times fourth rounders pan out. That's one of the many things that's interesting about the draft. It's like if you feel like, oh my God, they didn't get this guy in the first round. Well, there's six other rounds.
Yeah, I know. And all the positions, too. Yeah. It's like multi-layered stuff. I love it. I mean, I think it's really interesting. I don't know if the show business element of it.
I hear that.
I can pick it out. Yeah. But that kind of stuff
It is endless. I think mock drafts in all sports just fascinate me more than they should. they really do, because it's like, it's like there's kind of a Christmas morning aspect to, what if they get this guy? That would be really interesting.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it is. That's what the recruiting thing is, too, for college football fans. Yeah. So there you go.
So on that note, I guess we'll... say goodbye for another week. So
yeah, thanks very much to Devon Pinker.
Yes, and, indeed.
We'll be back with more of this fun stuff soon from the penthouse. He's Gordy, and I'm Mike. See you later.
See you later.